Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Some worry a plan to keep hemp out of prisons could go too far.
Meaning that if I show up there dropping somebody off and I've got a hemp book bag, am I going to run afoul of this and be committing a crime?
Also tonight, as an attempt to curb the use of nicotine products by minors, one Florida senator wants to make sure teens using vaping devices are properly penalized, but some think even more is necessary.
A $25 fine is all that's in place for a youth to possess a product illegally.
We'll also look at a plan to provide more protections for female prison inmates, as well as an effort to reform what critics have called a broken process for those who seek compensation after being harmed by government. It's week number two of the 2020 Florida lawmaking session. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Hemp and marijuana come from the same plant, and law enforcement officers often struggle to tell them apart. There's no quick field test to differentiate between the euphoric drug and its non-euphoric sister. In some communities, that's meant pressing pause on marijuana prosecutions. But Regan McCarthy reports it's also left big questions in prisons where marijuana is banned but hemp is not.
Representative Scott Plakin calls hemp in prison a clear and present danger.
Right now, someone bringing marijuana into one of our detention facilities, they have no way to detect whether that's hemp, which is legal, or marijuana, which is illegal. They have no way to detect that other than sending it to a lab and it takes a week or two to get back. Meanwhile, the crime would have already occurred.
The Longwood Republican says the state's rules about contraband need to be updated.
Recent changes in law and advancements in technology have created loopholes and inconsistency that pose serious risks to various detention facilities within our state.
In addition to banning hemp, Plakin wants to change the rules to keep vape pens out of state prisons, county jails, or juvenile justice facilities. He says he'd also like to clarify that cell phones aren't allowed in juvenile detention centers.
In 2019, we prohibited them in county facilities and state facilities, but left was juvenile detention and DCF facilities. So this bill would punish that as a first degree misdemeanor for introducing cell phones into those facilities.
But some are concerned Plakin's proposals could go too far. Pensacola Republican Representative Alex Andrade says he thinks intent should be considered before charging a person with a crime.
I don't know if any of y'all saw recently in Louisiana, there's a gentleman who was brought into the jail and had his cell phone on him. I asked for a charger to charge his cell phone after a minor arrest, and he was actually sentenced, I believe, to over 10 years in prison. For introducing a cell phone into that controlled facility.
Andrade says in this case, the person was in custody when he was brought into jail and was not intentionally bringing in contraband. He wants to ensure that same issue doesn't arise in Florida. And he's not the only one with concerns. Plantation Democratic Representative Mike Gottlieb worries the bill could capture people who are just visiting a facility. That's partly because the rules would apply to the grounds of prisons and jails.
Is the bill trying to criminalize the possession of industrial hemp on the grounds, meaning that if I show up there dropping somebody off and I've got a hemp book bag, am I going to run afoul of this and be committing a crime?
Plakin says that's not the intention, but Miami Beach Democratic Representative Mike Grieco says the bill could still apply to any number of things that a person has with them when they drive onto the grounds of a prison or jail. In fact, he says it could be part of current law that legislators should reconsider.
There are some unintended consequences when we start talking about the grounds of the facility. You know, obviously there's parking lots, and whether I bring a cell phone in my car or if I bring a firearm in my car, am I, according to the way the statute's written, it looks like I would be in violation of the statute as it's written now. So moving forward, I think that we need to take a look at that, both for the cell phones, firearms, controlled substances, things that people might legally have in their vehicle, and they would not even know that by driving onto the property of a correctional facility that somehow they'd be in violation of the law.
Flaken says he plans to work with lawmakers to look into those issues before his bill comes up for its second committee stop. Meanwhile, a similar bill in the Senate is awaiting its first committee hearing. I'm Regan McCarthy.
A bill aimed at enforcing a new federal law requiring a person to be 21 years old to purchase tobacco products, including vaporizers, is gaining steam in the Florida Senate. But proponents of vaping say proposed state penalties for violators aren't harsh enough to be effective. Blaise Ganey has the details.
Last month, Congress approved raising the age limit to buy e-cigarettes and tobacco to 21. This was something that was attempted in Florida last session but did not become law. The sponsor was Seminole County Republican Senator David Simmons.
As many as 30% of our youth are, and that's high school students, actually vaping.
Simmons says increases in teen vaping are due to online sales and kids selling to other kids.
How does a person who is in high school, how do our youth get these significant amounts of vaping products? They get it from the people who are close to them, who are 18 and 19 years of age.
His bill would create a $25 fine for anyone selling to a person under 21 and require the offender to attend an anti-tobacco program. Another $25 penalty would be imposed if a person violates again within 12 weeks. Those who fail to pay could have their driver's licenses suspended. But those in favor of the bill don't think those penalties go far enough.
If we're going to be combating youth access and usage, we need stronger enforcement against youth who are breaking the law. A $25 fine is all that's in place for a youth to possess a product illegally. You get more of a fine if you speed.
Jonathan Ristine is a vape shop owner. The bill also gives the same penalty to adults that give nicotine products to a person under 21. In fact, Ristine believes the bill hurts vape store owners the most.
When it comes to the bad players that are actually providing these products to youth, a majority, an overwhelming majority, according to the FDA, are convenience stores, gas stations, big box stores, and so on. Under 3% of infractions for youth sales are at vape brick and mortar shops.
Ristine says it hurts his business by requiring that they have a permit to sell, something currently not needed.
We have to require IDs for every single purchase at this point in time for anybody that appears to be under 27 years old.
Ristine says it also pushes people to buy products online, which he believes is more dangerous. To combat that, the bill requires a person to show ID and sign for a package containing nicotine or tobacco products. Opponents argue that requirement would increase shipping costs, but Broward County Democratic Senator Lauren Book says that's a small fee to pay to ensure safety.
In terms of some of the other provisions that folks have trouble with, signing and providing an ID, adding $16 to a purchase, I sign for shoes when I order them, and they're a certain cost. I think that when it comes to protecting our youth and our citizens, it's of the utmost importance, and I completely support this very good bill by Senator Simmons.
So did the rest of the committee, with Senate Bill 810 passing unanimously. Simmons says he will work to address the concerns raised, but as the actions taken are in response to an advisory from United States Surgeon General. He read some of it in his closing.
In bold statement, we must take action now to protect the health of our nation's young people.
In that same advisory, the Surgeon General declared e-cigarette use among kids an epidemic. The measure has two more committee stops in the Senate. A similar bill in the House hasn't been heard yet. I'm Blaise Ganey.
Amid a federal court challenge to a state law requiring felons to pay legal financial obligations to be eligible to vote, Governor Ron DeSantis and the Florida Cabinet unanimously signed off on a proposal Tuesday that would make it easier for felons who owe restitution to get their rights restored. The revised rule, approved by DeSantis and the Cabinet acting as the Board of Executive Clemency, is the latest move in a drawn-out legal and political battle over the restoration of rights in Florida. critics accusing the state of refusing to let go of a process designed to keep black people from voting. The revamped clemency rule will allow felons who have waited at least 7 years after they've completed their time behind bars and have fulfilled other requirements but owe restitution to victims to request a hearing from the clemency board. Under the current rules, restitution must be paid in full before felons can apply to have their rights restored. A Senate committee backed a proposal Tuesday that seeks to remember the bloodiest day in American political history and compensate descendants of people who 100 years ago were killed, injured, or lost land during violence in the Central Florida community of Ocoee. The Judiciary Committee approved a pair of measures that would set up a trust fund for descendants of the 1920 Ocoee Election Day riot, which happened after a black man tried to record the names of others blocked from voting in Ocoee. While the bill would offer up to $150,000 per victim, the overall compensation package would have to be negotiated by the legislature. Still to come on Capitol Report, the Florida legislature considers more protections for pregnant female prison inmates.
How can we as a state, a large state, allow such treatment of human beings to continue to go on within our criminal justice system?
And is it time to change the state's immunity laws? That's what Senator Anna Terry Flores wants to do.
I'm not terribly confident that it will pass in its current form this year, but I do hope that we have a conversation about it.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by Cloud Navigator, providing cloud computing services and creating secure and productive workplaces for businesses and government agencies. Cloud Navigator, a Microsoft Cloud Platform partner operating throughout the Southeast. On the web at cloudnav.com.
Dignity Florida is backing bills aimed at changing how pregnant incarcerated women are treated. The push comes after a woman gave birth alone in a Florida jail cell. Robbie Gaffney reports.
Pregnant women in the state's jails and prisons are supposed to get prenatal counseling, vitamins, exams, and a special diet. They're also sent to hospitals to give birth. But last year, an inmate filed an anonymous complaint saying that a woman named Tammy Jackson was ignored while giving birth in her cell. Dignity Florida campaign manager Valencia Gunder explains.
She was put in solitary confinement, and because she was a strong woman, she was able to give birth to her child by herself with no medical assistance, no medicine, or anything.
An investigation followed and a redacted report released. It found no misconduct. The report blacked out where Jackson was when she delivered her baby. It also accused Jackson of not being accurate on the details of her due date and being uncooperative. Dignity Florida is pushing an act to change how pregnant women are restrained, searched, and confined in prisons. It would apply to city and county jails as well as state correctional facilities.
Florida houses the second largest facility, female facility, in the country.
That's Valencia Gunder again.
That means we are incarcerating women in mass numbers here in our state. We want to be the lead on a lot of things, but not that.
Under the proposal, if a pregnant woman is being transported, officers would be limited in how they can restrain her. If a health professional asks for restraints to be removed, the officer must do so unless there is an extraordinary circumstance. And if a pregnant woman needs to be searched, only a medical professional can do so unless a correctional officer believes the woman is hiding contraband. The act would also ban pregnant prisoners from being placed in restrictive housing, with exceptions. Miami Democratic Senator Jason Pizzo is sponsoring the bill. He says it's about human decency.
We're not asking for extraordinary privileges, just part of the social contract of seeking rehabilitation of people that are incarcerated. This is not a big ask.
Last year, a bill was signed into law to allow female inmates to get free basic hygiene products like pads and tampons. It's called the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act.
But even with that passing, it's very clear that we realized that we could not stop here thanks to Valencia and her team.
That's Hollywood Democratic Representative Chevron Jones, the act's sponsor. After learning about Tammy Jackson's situation, he's supporting Pizzo's bill.
How can we as a state, a large state, allow such treatment of human beings to continue to go on within our criminal justice system.
According to the state, about 101 pregnant women were incarcerated from 2018 to 2019. Pizzo's measure passed its first committee stop. The House version has not yet been heard. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
Miami Republican Senator Anatiri Flores wants to change what she sees as an overly political and broken claims bill process. These bills are how people who've sued the state or local governments get the money they're owed. Right now, the state caps how much money it pays out. Lynn Hatter has more.
Sovereign immunity stems from the idea that a monarch, or in this case, a government, can do no wrong. Flores disagrees. She says the state's $200,000 and $300,000 caps for payouts aren't right. And the state's claims bill process, which is what victims have to file to get court-ordered settlements greater than that amount, is even worse.
The claims bill process sometimes really just comes down to are you friends with the right person? Mm-hmm. And there's got to be a better way to compensate a wronged individual or a wronged family.
Flores describes her proposal as a conversation starter. The idea of raising the cap on sovereign immunity to $500,000 is one local governments oppose and trial lawyers like. That was clear Tuesday in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
We call this the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow syndrome. If you increase the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, more people will come, as the staff analysis pointed out.
We know that 10 years ago when this happened, we did see increased costs both in settlement and litigation.
There will be less funding for public services, and there will be an increase in insurance premiums.
That was the Panhandle Area Education Consortium and the Florida Leagues of Cities and Counties. All oppose Flores's bill. Signing off in support are legal firms like the Tallahassee-based Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. It specializes in personal injury law. Local governments would be on the hook for the increased costs, and according to a staff analysis of the bill, it could very well lead to an increase in lawsuits and cost local governments more money. On the other hand are the victims, the people who've been injured, like when the Department of Children and Families fails to act when it knows of cases of abuse, or when a child gets hit by a school bus.
I've had some claims bills for young people who were injured by a public entity, namely at school.
That's Democratic Minority Leader Audrey Gibson.
One young man was shot and killed. One family, a bus, ran into them. And I think those families who are a part of the public deserve to have justice without necessarily having to come to the legislature.
It can take years for the legislature to approve a claims bill. In 2011, one of the most horrific cases of child abuse in the state led to the death of a young girl in foster care. Her brother was severely injured and needs medical care for the rest of his life. The state did not approve a $3.75 million claims bill for Victor Barahona until 2017. Former FSU football player Devon Darling's claims bill languished in the legislature for more than 12 years after he died in 2001 following a grueling practice session where team coaches ignored signs that Darling was in trouble. Many victims are still waiting. In the past, lawmakers have warred over the claims bill process. Some don't like them due to the influence of lawyers and lobbyists who often get a portion of the settlements the state has to pay. Families say they wouldn't have to hire those lawyers and lobbyists if the process was better.
I don't like windfalls. I don't like pots of gold. I don't like excessive fees that wind up more benefiting the law firm or the lobbyists that help people. I don't like claims bills.
Republican Senator Dennis Baxley has eschewed the claims bill process for just those reasons. This bill he likes.
But I tell you what, there are adverse outcomes, and there are times of responsibility, and there are valid damages. And I'd like an orderly system by which those needs are met and settled. And I think this bill moves in that direction.
Flores's proposal cleared its first committee hurdle, but she's under no illusion the bill will get through others. There is no House sponsor for the measure, something that lowers the bill's chances of making it through the legislature. The House has also historically been opposed to claims bills. Flores says she just wants to start the conversation.
I'm not terribly confident that it will pass in its current form this year, but I do hope that we have a conversation about it. It's something that has to continue beyond my tenure here because claims bills are always part of the process, and we've got to improve, in my opinion, the way that we deal with them.
This is Flores's last session as a state lawmaker. She's term limited this year. She's currently carrying two claims bills. One is for a South Florida man who was shot four times and paralyzed after a sheriff's deputy mistook the man's cell phone for a gun. Another man became a quadriplegic after a doctor recommended against a surgery despite evidence it was necessary. I'm Len Hatter.
Gina Jordan reports lawmakers have a busy agenda on Wednesday.
Here's a look at what's happening at the Capitol. Wednesday is Florida Tourism Day. A coalition of tourist industry groups will hold a news conference and a rally to highlight the impact of tourism in Florida. A Senate panel considers whether minors must have parental consent before having an abortion. Another proposal would require the Florida Talent Development Council to submit recommendations for a program known as PTEC. That stands for Pathways in Technology Early College High School. The bill would allow students to earn a diploma, an associate's degree, and industry certifications with work experience within 6 years of entering the ninth grade. The full Senate meets for a floor session. The chamber will take up a repeal of the Constitution Revision Commission, which meets every 20 years. The so-called sunscreen bill is also on the agenda. The Florida Drug and Cosmetic Act would preempt the regulation of over-the-counter drugs or cosmetics to the state level after the city of Key West banned certain sunscreen containing ingredients that could harm coral reefs. And finally, tomorrow is Florida Space Day. The event brings awareness to legislators and the public on the significance of the aerospace industry and its impact on the state's economy. That's some of what's coming up at the Capitol. I'm Gina Jordan.
Legislation filed at the Capitol seeks to curb violent threats against transit workers, due in part to an attack that killed a Hillsborough County bus driver last year. The measure would make it a felony to assault a uniformed transit worker, require the installation of protective barriers to separate drivers from riders, and require training for drivers on how to de-escalate potentially violent situations. The measure is yet to be heard by a committee in the Florida House or Senate, with the legislature in now the second week of its nine-week regular session. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, the impeachment of President Donald Trump has cast a spotlight on Orlando Congresswoman Val Demings. As the impeachment trial was getting underway, WMFE's Matthew Petty says a life in law enforcement has been pivotal in the life of the 62-year-old Democrat.
Before she was picked as one of seven impeachment managers, Congresswoman Val Demings was Orlando's first female police chief, a social worker, and the youngest of seven children. Her husband of more than 30 years, Orange County Mayor Jerry Demings, also broke barriers in his rise through the ranks of law enforcement. Now the Demings are one of Orlando's most powerful political couples. In a conversation recorded by StoryCorps last year with her husband, Demings talked about growing up in a two-bedroom house in rural Jacksonville.
But you know, Jerry, I grew up extremely poor, but at the time, we really didn't know how poor we were.
Demings says she couldn't remember a day her father didn't go to work as a gardener, a janitor, picking oranges, whatever work he could find to put food on the table.
My parents just really worked hard to make sure that we had as much as we could. And when I look back now, I know they sacrificed a lot.
Demings was competitive as a kid. She was on the track team. She played in band and sang in chorus. And she told the Orlando Sentinel in an interview in 2007 that she got bitten by the police bug early. As a sixth grader, she was picked for school patrol, helping classmates cross the road and helping break up fights on the school bus on the way home. And as the first in her family to go to college, Demings felt obligated to give back.
Like you, Jerry, to have the opportunity to work my way through the ranks and to be appointed the chief of police, the first woman, was just an honor. And I took that job very, very seriously, as I do my current job as a member of Congress. It's all about trying to save the world.
When she was appointed Orlando's police chief in 2007, Val and Jerry Demings held the area's top two law enforcement positions. Her husband was Orange County's first African-American sheriff. Trial attorney Mark Niejames says even though there were sometimes adversaries in the courtroom, Demings gained his respect and friendship.
It's just been watching that journey continue. As she advanced, she didn't step over people either. She worked hard and deserved everything she got.
Republican political analyst Frank Torres says Demings' leadership as chief was on display during a shooting at a downtown office in 2009 that brought the city to a standstill.
And I think you saw her really step up there during that situation to sort of work with elected officials to both take down the threat and to keep people calm during a very, very nervous time.
When Demings retired from the police force in 2011, Torres said the logical next step was a career in politics.
As soon as she left the job, she was immediately being rumored for office.
After a few unsuccessful bids for office, Demings was elected to Congress in 2016. Since, her political stature has grown. She's on the U.S. House Committees on Intelligence, the Judiciary, and Homeland Security. Former Democratic state lawmaker Dick Batchelor says her leadership and law enforcement credentials landed her the role of impeachment manager.
Notwithstanding how the trial comes out, she is recorded in perpetuity in the history books of playing a very key role only after being in the Congress in a very short period of time, but earning her stripes, as it were, in very short order.
Demings' name has been floated as a potential vice presidential candidate, but asked about that by reporters, she had this to say.
This is not about Val Demings. It's not about Donald Trump. It's not about Donald Trump's defenders. This is about protecting our democracy, protecting our republic.
Demings is the only non-lawyer with a spot on the impeachment prosecution team, but she says that's not a problem. Her 27 years in law enforcement has prepared her for this historic role. I'm Matthew Petty in Orlando.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Gainey, Robbie Gaffney, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Matthew Petty. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us every weeknight at this time throughout the 2020 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flafl-cio.org.